Chapter 2, Compromise Structures. You can't shoot yourself in the head twice, can you? This chapter seeks to highlight some relevant structural aspects and deficits which provide the necessary context within which child sexual abuse cover-up and corruption can and do happen. The different compromise structures of the Scottish legal establishment, which are referred to, are more consistent with the rule of lawyers than with the rule of law. I've been pretty vocal on Twitter and in the media about the need to investigate and determine facts and about what seem to be allegations of organised child sexual abuse in Scotland, which have persisted for decades now, or at least child sexual abuse with an organised element. You can find the detail on Twitter with the handle at Advocate Hallie or just by googling my name. Of course, when you Google my name now, the search results will feature all the media about my arrest and about Ladysmith's monstering of me. That's because in order to make the monstering most effective, Ladysmith's underlings and the BBC put my name in the hyperlinks or search criteria or however it works. A child abuse inquiry. I got more media attention from SCAI than their own subsequent case study, more like a holiday brochure, on Loreto School, and that can be found in the Daily Record by googling their article. SCAI had to be careful with Loreto. Both SCAI's senior counsel had links to Loreto. I must have really stumbled onto something. Is it Queen Victoria School in Dunblane? Again, Google it, there's media about that. Or Fornethy House Respite Facility for wee girls from Glasgow in Perthshire. Again, there are media articles reporting about allegations of organised child sexual abuse at Fornethy. Or the Metropolitan Police, the London Police Force, operating in East Lothian and Edinburgh, investigating the trafficking of young people from Scotland to London in 1996, when the principal lead featured Lord Hardy's bank account. See my note at Chapter 17. Lord Hardy is another retired judge. He has the services of 3X1 Group available to him too for the Edinburgh Trams inquiry. The stench. I think it's also significant that Ladysmith herself has been reluctant to name even prolific paedophiles in her capacity as SCAI chair. Again, there are newspaper reports and media about the reluctance to name an allegedly prolific child abuser, Ian Wares, who's the subject of extradition proceedings in South Africa. Ladysmith appears to be certain about restriction orders when they prevent people from naming paedophiles in relation to Edinburgh private schools. She's very assertive that her orders are to be followed. However, she and her whole inquiry team are to be regarded as honest but hopelessly mistaken lawyers when she made unlawful restriction orders about my disability discrimination claim against her in 2019. You can see this on the Scottish Courts Judgments website, the BBC against Right Honourable Ladysmith. That's cited at 2022 Court of Session Inner House, that's CSIH 5. And surprisingly, the leader of a mistaken but honest lawyer group in Ladysmith's legal team is Dunlop, the Dean of Faculty. Are these matters really the sort of details that a public inquiry for the investigation of historical child sexual abuse should be trying to keep secret? As you'll have seen from the links in the previous paragraph, one guy, Ian Wares, was a teacher at Fettes School in Edinburgh Academy, Edinburgh, in the 1970s. He's the subject of multiple serious allegations of sexual abuse of children he was responsible for teaching. Still, Ladysmith had an SCAI restriction order in place, preventing identification of him as such until it had to be challenged by survivors, including the broadcaster Nikki Campbell, in 2023. Wares lives in South Africa. The Scottish Prosecution Authority, COPFS, is trying to extradite Wares. Wares seems to have a very useful and possibly fundamentally correct legal argument based on the new South African constitutional setup, which might prevent his extradition. So survivors were not able to name Wares, Crown Office is not able to extradite him, justice was denied to survivors, at least in part, by Ladysmith and the groupthink. Ian Blackford MP named Wares in the House of Commons as an abuser of children at Fettes School and Edinburgh Academy in the 1970s. The Times had the guts to report the name of Wares. The BBC followed suit. So did other newspapers. Then the BBC removed his name. So did other newspapers. All because Ladysmith and COPFS were threatening them with legal action. Very Ladysmith and the groupthink. Not very able and a bit off beam. For naming a paedophile. Note the SCAI and COPFS collaboration that's so misguided that no matter how well founded in law, it appears to operate to protect a serial paedophile. These are not exactly the essential prerequisites for the exercise of balanced judgment in sensitive matters affecting vulnerable people. But Ladysmith relented. She's very interested in holding public hearings in relation to abuse in the Edinburgh private schools. Now the survivors feel listened to. You can read all about that in the media reports as well. She's apparently not very interested in investigating the organised sexual abuse and child trafficking of children in the care system in Scotland, however, especially when lawyers and judges may have been involved. From my perspective, the clear message imparted to others about the monstering seems to be this. If you mess with Ladysmith and the senior judges in Scotland, you might find yourself set up to look like a child sex offender in the media. Who cares about the truth, justice, reputation, family, or even the protection of children? This is about power. Power without accountability. Don't mess with the Scottish judges. They know no limits. In addition, there was a conspiracy of knowledge that I was to be arrested months before the bizarre execution of the arrest itself on 15th of February 2023. I didn't know. This is in sharp contrast with the efforts that have gone into protecting, by keeping all information quiet and to a minimum, Sheriff Alistair Duff since October 2021. There's more on this later. But for present purposes, the Judicial Office for Scotland, the BBC, The Times and other media outlets might reasonably be viewed as having soft-pedaled media about Duff's arrest for what were belatedly called communication offences by COPFS. Not sexual offences like me, communication offences. Duff was arrested in October 2021 and permitted to retire on 1st December 2021. No one's entitled to know anything about this. All power in relation to the issue rests with his close professional associate, Lord Carloway, the Lord President, Scotland's most senior judge. And he appears to be accountable to no one about that or about many other matters. Duff has many other close, long-standing and enduring personal connections right at the top of the Scottish legal establishment. The irresistible inference is that Duff is being protected. Contrast that with the media monstering of me. I'm told by journalists that I'm the only case in which the Judicial Office for Scotland has been quite so keen to give as much detail as possible. A person who is not implicated in child sexual abuse in any way. Monstering. As to the conspiracy of knowledge, I already know that I was regarded by one media solicitor as, quote, discredited by about mid-December 2022. The solicitor in question is called Campbell Dean. I don't know him at all. He's a Glasgow solicitor who holds himself out as an expert in media law. His firm is Ballantyne Kirkwood France. He legals for different newspapers. Legaling for newspapers is an interesting, unregulated enterprise in Scotland. Paul McBride, QC, now deceased, one of my two devil masters in the Faculty of Advocates, legaled for various newspapers for years. McBride was notoriously indiscreet. He told me lots of facts about lots of advocates, judges, and others. McBride knew the criminal law back to front and was razor sharp on his feet in court. Very effective in criminal trials as a prosecutor or as defence counsel. I've been his devil, his junior counsel, and even his opponent when I was a High Court prosecutor. I know. But he knew nothing at all about any component part of what might be regarded as civil law. Like most of what the law is. Anecdotal reports of the legal assessment for content in the press always sounded extremely ropey to me. There didn't appear to be much legal content. For one hideous example, see the awful story of Denise Clare and the footballers Goodwillie and Robertson. Again, you can Google the media reports about these. Dorothy Bain, the present Lord Advocate, represented Goodwillie at proof in civil proceedings and unsuccessfully on appeal. You can see the media about those matters, and you can see the degree to which Bain went to in order to press the case for his appeal in the Inner House judgment. Bain had held the position of principal advocate depute until a few weeks prior to the decision not to proceed with the prosecutions of Goodwillie and Robertson on 25th of July 2011. Other examples of ropey no-pro decisions in Crown Office are referred to in my note for SCAI, dated 1st of April 2019 and reproduced here at Chapter 17. Read it later. McBride's legaling practice often seemed to have been operated in conjunction with his ability to turn up at Crown Office and persuade those responsible that actually, cases against his clients shouldn't be prosecuted at all. Like Douglas Haggerty, head of legal services at SLAB, the Scottish Legal Aid Board, usually lifted after an incident with a boy in a public toilet. McBride sat on the SLAB board with Haggerty. McBride also earned his substantial fee income from SLAB, and yet represented Haggerty whenever these cases were presented at Crown Office. Anyway, back to Dean's legaling and me being discredited. John Glover, a very junior journalist at the Scottish Daily Express at the time, had been allowed by his editor to print a series of articles focused on and around my note for SCAI, dated 1st of April 2019. This was in late 2022 to early 2023. You can Google the articles, for example, at scottishdailyexpress.co.uk/news. He was interested in the magic circle aspects and in what Susie Henderson had to say about her father, Shiny Bob Henderson, QC. In relation to him, you can also see the BBC's podcast, Shiny Bob, the Devil's Advocate. The articles were also interested in others, including Lord Hardy. Lord Hardy is now a retired Scottish judge, sometimes described as an ex-judge, a man who has enjoyed ultimate power within a very small legal system and establishment. A man who had the power as Lord Advocate to appoint all judges, the last Lord Advocate to have that power, the right of patronage. Yes, even in 2000. Many of Hardy's appointees still hold office at the very highest UK levels. A man whose last appointment to judicial office was of himself, although he says it was on the recommendation of Donald Dewar. A man whose conduct has never been properly investigated in relation to serious allegations of sexual misconduct towards a child, Susie Henderson, and a young man in care. Lord Hardy still enjoys a lot of power, even now. He's been chairing the public inquiry into the Edinburgh Trams project for almost 10 years. No disciplinary proceedings for Lord Hardy, mildly criticised in 2022 for not reporting allegations of child sexual abuse by his devil and friend John Watt, KC. You can also Google the articles about that in about August 2022. The critics failed to mention that one of the complainers about Watt, the same Susie Henderson, has also alleged over many years that Hardy sexually abused her when she was a child. Mildly criticised in 2023 for earning too much money when chairing the Edinburgh Trams inquiry. Again, you can Google the media articles. But no mention of anything more serious. Expressio unius est exclusio alterius. This is a Latin maxim that's still part of the law of Scotland, and it means the expression of one matter must mean the exclusion of anything else. Lord Hardy is apparently protected. It was a surprise to me that Glover had been allowed by his editor to run these articles from late 2022 to early 2023. It seemed odd that such a journalistic novice should be permitted to cover and print such controversial material. I suspected I was being set up. Glover was even encouraged to send me information I viewed as a thinly veiled threat. It was a reference to Willie McRae, a Scottish nationalist stalwart who died in mysterious circumstances and was supposed to have shot himself in the head twice. Again, you can Google the media articles about Willie McRae. You can't shoot yourself twice in the head. I'd never heard of McRae before, but I thought this might be a threat. I still suspect I was being set up all along. Glover appeared to be young, inexperienced and naive, but maybe not as naive as me. He phoned me regularly at the time of the articles. He presented as really interested in getting to the truth. On the 15th of December 2022 he phoned me. We were talking about my input into an article to be published soon. Glover slipped into the conversation that his editor had been told I was, quotes, discredited. I gently asked who said that. Glover told me his editor had been advised that I was discredited by the solicitor who legaled for the Scottish Daily Express. He had been told he should be careful about the information and detail provided by me because of that. I asked the name of the solicitor. Glover told me his name was Campbell Dean. Glover asked me not to make a fuss. I told him I wouldn't. At 17:14 hours on the 15th of December 2022, emailed Campbell Dean. I've never spoken to him, I don't know him, I've never seen him in a court, he's never appeared before me or against me. I had no idea why Campbell Dean would be advising the editor of the Scottish Daily Express that I was discredited. I googled him and sent him an email in the following terms. Dear Mr. Dean, I understand that you use the term discredited in relation to my professional reputation when advising the editor of the Scottish Daily Express in relation to defamation, ironically. I will be pleased to receive an explanation of what exactly you meant by the term discredited, whether it is your view or that of other named persons. What was meant by the term when you used it, and on what evidence is the use of the term predicated? I look forward to receiving your response. Regards, John Halley, Advocate. Within minutes, Glover was on the phone again. His relaxed and almost flippant manner was no longer. He was audibly traumatized. His voice was quivering and shaking like a child. He sounded like he'd been crying. He told me he'd been called in by his editor. The editor had been contacted by Campbell Dean. Glover was given a rocket and told he'd be sacked unless I agreed not to do anything in relation to Dean. I told Glover to relax. I said I wouldn't take any action against Dean. I told him I was just marking Dean's card in case his comment was a reference to something specific. Well, it was. But I had no idea at the time. I shrugged the discredited insult off and thought, that's fine, there's no basis for it. I'll be in contact with Mr. Dean in a wee while. I'm sure he'll make an excellent witness. In retrospect, I wish I'd taken immediate action against Campbell Dean. If I'd done that, I might have become aware that it was an open secret in circles within the Scottish legal profession that I'd been discredited and that I was going to be arrested in relation to allegations of sexual offences. The secret had been at large for months from late 2022 until the arrest in February 2023. I can prove all of that and worse. Now, if there had been a complaint about me made to the police, then any leak about this matter must have come from them or from the complainer. Both are unlikely for reasons that I'll explain later. The complainer is behaving as if the media about me has absolutely nothing to do with her. Living her best life, moving and working closer and closer to where I live. The police don't have ready access to the legal profession in general. However, if the discrediting information was leaked through Lady Smith and the SCAI, that would explain such information being at large in legal circles in Scotland. That's more likely, for reasons I'll explain. Was it known by my faculty colleagues, by the Dean of Faculty, Dunlop? Have you seen his Twitter account? At RoddyQC. At about that time, he suddenly began tweeting about predatory men and paedophiles. You can look at it and see. Not issues he'd previously been particularly interested in, especially about Hardy, Duff and others. He couldn't be drawn on that stuff. Could there possibly be an open secret at large in the legal world in Scotland that Dunlop doesn't know about? A secret that Lady Smith and her SCAI group thinkers knew about and maybe even had more involvement with? But this has been a really nasty, vicious setup, executed but in a different way from McRae, but executed just the same. It's been frightening for my family. We've been very worried about evidence being planted and even personal safety. My execution was long in the planning and knowing anticipation, yet fundamentally defective. Lady Smith had to go too far in the mass media she shaped. Media monstering. Carried out and conducted by Graham McKendry, former News of the World hack. I know that the authorities and various other players and people in and around the legal profession in Scotland knew that I was going to be arrested and accused of committing sexual offences. That knowledge was at large for months before the date of my arrest on 15th of February 2023. Even the editor of Scottish Legal News, Graham Ogilvy, knew about it months in advance of it happening, certainly prior to Christmas 2022, according to one lawyer. He'll be an important witness, that's Ogilvy, along with the others. The BBC's Andrew Picken included. I'm a fairly effective cross-examiner. There was therefore a period of months for Ladysmith and the groupthink to prepare the monstering in the press and media. This scenario is about as callous and cynical as could be put together. Why me? What risk did I pose? And to whom? Ladysmith can behave in the way she has behaved, monstering me in the media, acting well beyond her statutory powers as chair of a public inquiry under the Inquiries Act 2005, claiming to be a, quotes, Supreme Court judge in Scotland after the date of her retirement, and all without being held to account by anyone. There appears to be a big problem in Scotland. The senior judiciary, including retirees like Ladysmith and Lord Hardy, appear to be accountable to no one and to no authority. With Ladysmith as the prime example, some behave as if the law does not apply to them at all. Lord Carloway too, the Lord President of the Court of Session. He, however, has said, I am quoting, until such time as it's demonstrated that there is corruption within the Scottish judiciary, I'm entirely satisfied that there is no requirement for a register of interests and that it would be positively detrimental to the administration of justice, particularly in relation to the recruitment of judges and especially at the higher level of the judiciary. That comment is replicated in one of his judgments. That time has arrived. I've learned from my own experience that even if you have a sound case in law against the likes of Ladysmith, you will not succeed. Dunlop has told me as much in a disciplinary dean's direction dated 31st of August 2022. Now that's not because of the law. It's because of the lawyers, including the judges. It's simply because you won't be allowed to succeed. That's corruption. Setting up a person on fabricated criminal charges and then monstering the person in the media by making it appear to the general public that the person is a child sexual abuser takes the corruption to a new level. That's where we are in Scotland. A child abuse inquiry that's reluctant to name prolific paedophiles, yet which is apparently only too keen to portray an opponent, an enemy, or a threat as implicated in child sexual abuse, when such an implication is entirely false, and they know it. I understand that most law-abiding people will have great difficulty in believing that there could be corruption at the top of the Scottish judiciary. I'm genuinely surprised and perturbed to discover its existence and its extent. And no one appears to be prepared to challenge it. The structures that are in place foster and reinforce that approach. If you challenge those in control, you lose. If you continue to challenge, you'll lose everything. They'll even candidly tell you that. They've told me that. You see how and when later. But if you cooperate, turn a blind eye, get on with the task in hand, and make yourself the right appointee, then you'll be trusted and rewarded. I know very many lawyers and judges in Scotland whose honesty is not in question in any way. The othering process forces good people to be passive in the face of injustice and corruption, relieved that it's not them. Scotland is a small country, a small legal jurisdiction. Lawyers and others in Scotland regularly claim that the Scottish legal system is admired and envied by other jurisdictions the world over. I think someone once said it, maybe in the 19th century, but definitely not now. I don't see other jurisdictions rushing to copy what Scotland is doing. The Scottish legal system has become somewhat insular, quirky, resistant to evidence-based change. Important changes are often misguided and or contrary to scientifically demonstrated evidence. Of course, scientifically demonstrated evidence is different from evidence gathered in relation to people's opinions. Modifying and adjusting legal procedures and laws, especially in relation to the criminal law, based on people's opinions, is a dangerous manner in which to proceed. One current example relates to the sentencing of young people under 25 after they've been convicted of crimes. Developmental science is said to have been the primary consideration in fashioning new guidelines. Of course, it's correct to emphasise that rehabilitation should be a primary consideration when sentencing young people. But the new Scottish guidelines have caused justified public concern because of the unacceptable consequences in the disposals of violent and sexual crimes. And you can Google the case of Sean Hogg, for example. Developmental issues in relation to children and young people who are accused and convicted of crimes would be better to be anchored in law, in the terms already provided in the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. There exists a coherent scientific consensus which demonstrates that children and young people are developmentally disadvantaged in forensic communications with adults in authority in the criminal justice systems. This scientific consensus would be better employed in ensuring that investigation and trial processes and procedures address the developmental disadvantages and deficits suffered by children and young people prior to conviction. This approach to ensuring that the law and its procedures are developmentally appropriate would help to ensure that children's and young people's rights are properly given effect to and protected. Also, those children and young people who ought not to be convicted would be better placed to be acquitted. You don't need to rehabilitate someone who's lawfully and properly acquitted. The sentencing guideline stuff is just one example of these very powerful, unaccountable, sometimes misguided judges effectively changing the way the law operates. They're not elected, this isn't democracy, and they're wrong. They have changed the effective operation of the law to the detriment of victims and contrary to the public interest. And all because they've misapplied the scientific knowledge about brain development in young people. It's not the science that's at fault. It's the somewhat misguided way it's being used. But the underlying tendency is to appropriate greater and greater powers to an unaccountable judiciary at the top. They're apparently eager to dispense with juries and replace them with single-judge determinations. To change important aspects of the law of evidence by judicial decision-making rather than by legislation, to close down and punish whistleblowers and those who criticise. Lord Carloway steadfastly refuses to agree to a meaningful register of judicial interests. They call it judicial independence. They dress it up as related to the rule of law. Oh, and they've raised the age of retirement to 75. The system needs their unique talents for longer. It's not the rule of law, it's the rule of lawyers. Another manifestation of this judicial power grab has been enunciated very recently in the case of Kirkwood against Thelem Assurances. That's cited as 2023 Court of Session in our house. That's CSIH 30. The judgment's dated 23rd of July 2023. Lord President Carloway made new law providing that only Scottish solicitors should be permitted to conduct litigation in Scotland in the following pronouncement, and I quote. Decision, paragraph 29. It is important that litigation in Scotland is A, conducted by those whom the court has authorised to do so, and B, subject to the expenses regime which the court has devised. The former is concerned with not only the efficiency of the system, that is, that causes are conducted by those fully conversant with Scots law and procedure. It is also to ensure that those conducting it are subject to the disciplinary rules either exercised by the court itself or delegated by the court to the Faculty of Advocates or the Law Society of Scotland. Close quotes. In the context of what's written in this text, I invite you to note that the Judicial Office for Scotland informed Russell Finlay MSP in January 2023 that Lord Hardy is not subject to its disciplinary procedures or regime because he's a retired judge, an ex-judge. Ladysmith and others chairing public inquiries in Scotland are retired judges too. Lord Hardy is described, as I say, as an ex-judge. Ladysmith is described, on the other hand, as a Supreme Court judge in Scotland. These people are beyond the disciplinary regime considered by the Lord President to be so important. The rules are only for some. The rule of lawyers, not the rule of law. Apart from its resistance to scientific, evidence-based procedures, the Scottish legal system is manned by a relatively small body of lawyers and judges in comparison with other larger jurisdictions with bigger populations. The pool of people at the top of the judiciary and legal profession is very small indeed. In that situation, it's critically important to ensure that there is structural integrity to guarantee objective and impartial decision-making. I emphasise the need for structural integrity. Structural integrity might usefully be contrasted with personal integrity. Of course, personal integrity is vital, but it's not sufficient to guarantee objective and impartial decision-making. Personal integrity differs from person to person. The proximity of long-standing personal and professional relationships can be problematic in such a small legal system. Claiming that particular individuals are, quotes, incorruptible, is not sufficient to guarantee the necessary objectivity and impartiality. And you can see Dunlop's pronouncement on the subject on his Twitter feed. This is especially the case where there are known personal relationships between important actors and decision makers in the prosecution and or court system, especially right at the top. The obvious illustration is the proximity of relationship between the present Lord Advocate and the senior judiciary. This is a separate and distinct issue from the Lord Advocate's constitutional conflict of interest as the supposedly independent head of Scotland's prosecution system, but at the same time a Scottish Government cabinet minister and legal representative. So apart from all of that, the present Lord Advocate's husband is Lord Turnbull. Lord Turnbull is a judge of the First Division of the Inner House of the Court of Session, necessarily close to the Lord President in the development of the policy and administrative aspects of the law. The Lord Advocate has both criminal and civil responsibilities and competencies. Some of the circumstances which highlight and found on below demonstrate the weaknesses and difficulties with the proximity of relationships in such a small legal system. It's not just the Lord Advocate's connections, of course. The long-standing, close, personal and professional relationship between the Lord President and the Lord Justice Clerk is well known. One analytical model that might be used to test the proximity of relationships in such a small, gossip-ridden legal system is the dinner table test. If actors, authorities and decision-makers, including judges, sit daily at the same dinner table as others, then that may indicate uncomfortable or problematic proximity, which might appear to undermine the guarantee of objective, impartial policy and decision-making. If it's the breakfast, lunch and supper tables too, then the problem might be more acute. At the outset, I expressed concern about the stench of corruption. Once you've got it in your nostrils, in relation to the integrity of judicial decision-making in a small system with problems of proximity of individuals, you can smell it in many other situations. The proximity of relationships between important decision-makers makes that stench stronger, especially after inexplicable and even odd judicial determinations. For one prominent example, see the Inner House decision in the BBC against Lady Smith. That judgment can be found at Court of Session Inner House, that's CSIH 2022-5. The Inner House judgment in BBC against Lady Smith provides a snapshot of how the rule of lawyers, rather than the rule of law, is sustained and perpetuated. This is explained more fully in Chapter 13.